Good afternoon. Welcome to the Asia Scotland Institute podcast. I'm Sean Patterson. Joining me today is Kaleem Hussain, a multidisciplinary change management consultant, analyst, and geopolitical observer. He's the founder and managing director of Guidance Consultancy, a multidisciplinary change management and international relations research organization, an honorary fellow at the Edward Cadbury Centre for the Public Understanding of Religion, and an RANA network expert. He's author of a new book titled Peace and Reconciliation in International and Islamic Law, which we'll be discussing today. Kaleem, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Pleasure to join you. Thank you.
So, Kaleem, many of us in Scotland and across the UK might not have the clearest understanding of Islamic law and how it can be applied to international reconciliation. So if you could just start by explaining some of the basic principles for us.
Thank you very much. I think this is one of the aspects which I focus on in my book, and that was one of the kind of prime reasons I wrote it, is to look at the canopies of the different systems of not only international law, but also Islamic law, and obviously inform the readership. And this is something which I elaborate on in my first chapter. So in a simplistic way, when we use the term Sharia or Sharia law, it pretty much means a pathway towards, you know, an easy pathway towards a destination. You know, Sharia in Arabic means a road, a journey. And the canopy of jurisprudence within Islamic law is very rich. You know, you have a rich tradition based on scholarly tradition. So just to give you an example, the schools of Islamic law, we have major figureheads at the top of that. So we have Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Muhammad Idris al-Shafi, Imam Malik, Imam bin Hanbal. And then even the other schools of thought, they have other, you know, jurisprudential methodologies such as Jafri fiqh. And what that does is it provides a holistic canopy of governance and a structure based on humane principles and ethics, on how to go about dealing with all aspects of life, from your personal matters, from your, you know, from a societal level. And then when it comes to the aspects of my book, which is the international kind of humanitarian paradigm that exists. So this is the essence of Islamic law, and it's orientated towards a peace. You know, the direction of travel is about peace. It's about harmony. It's about civility within society at large. So this is something which I feature in and cover in my book. Yeah.
Perfect. Thanks for explaining that. Now, of course, the title of your book is Peace and Reconciliation in International and Islamic Law. So how does Islamic law differ from international law as it currently exists and we understand it? Do they perhaps travel in the same direction? Do they complement each other? What are some of the sort of similarities and differences between the two?
Thank you very much. I mean, this is one of the, obviously, my endeavors that I explored in my book was to look at the synergies and the similarities and the differences. And what I actually found is when I was looking at the canopy of international law, just to give you an example, we have structures such as arbitration, we have a peace and reconciliation within international law structure, we have international courts of justice, we have human rights bodies which exist, we have the United Nations structure, and we have obviously humanitarian principles, as I alluded to. So when I looked at Islamic law, what I found is there's a lot of synergies in Islamic law, as in the principles of human rights are very much resonate within Islamic law, because within the ethics and teachings of Islamic law talks about the rights of God and the rights of people. There's the humanitarian essence within Islamic law also. And just to for the benefits of your readership, even when it comes to when you do have conflict, the rules of warfare, the ethics of warfare in terms of how do you go about when you are in a state of war, and what are you allowed to do, and what you're not allowed to do. So just to give examples, things like, you know, the elderly, the frail people, you are not allowed to harm them. You know, indiscriminate killing of innocents is not allowed. You know, combatants, non-combatants. These are some of the things that are covered in. But if you look at some of the differences, I would say is that one of the things what I found, which is especially from a faith-based paradigm, is when you look at these analysis, is that the dignity of the dead. So the right to a speedy burial. This is something which in traditional faith-based scholarship, you will find is pretty much very important. And sometimes, although you'll find that in international legal law structures, the importance of that may be negated. And you know, that aspect of sadly, you have seen in recent history in international affairs, places like what happened in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, you know, that kind of practice is just not, you know, is just totally uncalled for. And would be reprimanded. And then when it comes to peace and reconciliation, sometimes what you have in international law is, you know, when somebody's, you know, sovereignty is intervened, or somebody feels they've been attacked or wronged, there's an element of retribution, you know, time for payback. You need to go back and find the culprits, and et cetera, et cetera. and then the coalition kind of materializes. Whereas in international Islamic law, there is the principle of restorative justice and the principle of healing and reconciliation, which plays a more pivotal role.
Absolutely. So did you write this book in part as a response to sort of 20 years of Western intervention in the Islamic world? And perhaps we've seen throughout that we have not had the best understanding of Islamic law and Islamic principles. So do you think that it's important that Western audiences learn to understand these sort of key principles of Islamic law before, you know, we intervene in that part of the world?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons for writing this book is, yes, partly there's a misunderstanding a lot of the time in contemporary audiences in the West around the principle of Islamic law. It can be a loaded term. So just, you know, terminology such as jihad is always kind of misconstrued. And I cover that in my book, explaining the lexical aspect of what jihad is. I mean, on a simplistic level, it means struggle, to make an effort. So, you know, you can make an effort to educate yourself. That's a jihad, you know, to better society, your environment. That's the jihad. But often it's obviously assumed to be linked to warfare, pillage, destruction, etc., which is not helpful. But one of the main reasons I wanted to write this book and what kind of drove me to is that when you look at some of the conflict theaters around the world, we are in an age what they call forever wars, and it's called never-ending wars, which just don't seem to be coming to an end. And I realized that a lot of these theaters of conflict are Muslim-majority countries. And I said, when it comes to resolving these conflicts, are we using the tools of Islamic diplomacy, you know, Islamic law, which is a rich tradition, as part of the brokering and facilitating and interlocutors in this process, or is this just not getting any traction at all? So this is something that really kind of intrigued me, and I wanted to explore as to, you know, looking at the canopy, and then if you were to apply this in some of these theaters, you know, would it actually work in practice?
Absolutely. So do you think that in that part of the world, there's more legitimacy coming from Islamic law than there would be from international law?
Yes. So, I mean, obviously, we have to bear in mind that, you know, many of these countries have diverse, societies of multiple faith traditions and none. But where there is a primarily, a presence, a Muslim majority presence, obviously, for a lot of these people, their prime modus operandi in terms of jurisdiction is Islamic law. So from an authority perspective, if somebody is citing, you know, whatever kind of rulings or norms based on Islamic jurisprudence and understanding, the likelihood of them taking heed and, you know, acknowledging that and, you know, adhering to that is probably a lot more greater than the not so. So that is something which is very important, I think, in that prism of understanding. So, and obviously, as I already alluded to, the high-rise principles across the two systems, there's a lot of synergy. So principle of justice, principle of human rights, principle of humanitarianism, these are, you know, currents which exist across both of the systems. So sometimes you can almost say in a kind of convoluted kind of way that even though international legal structure already has Islamic components in it, you know, automatically.
That's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. One of the key parts of your book is this concept that you call theodiplomacy. Now, could you elaborate on that for the audience?
Yes, so I'm just going to kind of use the term which I've used in my book. And the term I use to describe it is theodiplomacy is an approach wherein the interlocutors and advisors of the parties to a situation of conflict have religious literacy, appreciation, and understanding of the contextual sensitivities of the conflict to help facilitate a pathway towards peace and reconciliation. So what is intertwined in that is the principle of, you know, faith literacy or religious literacy. And the point I'm making is that a lot of our interlocutors or diplomats, when they're engaging in conflict or in conflict resolution, you know, do we have that at the ready at our disposal? And because having this kind of knowledge, my argument is that having that at the table would act as a facilitative tool and most likely lead to a speedier resolution to a conflict than not so, because they'll understand the nuances and the contextual, you know, determinants of what is happening in that particular region. Yeah.
So who would you find to be your theodiplomats? Are we talking sort of faith leaders, or, you know, who makes a good theodiplomat?
Yeah, so very great question. So I think as part of my analysis, when I looked at this, it will include a multifaceted canopy. Yes, you'll have the faith leaders from the different faith traditions, so the rabbis, the priests, the sheikhs, the imams, and these will be leading authorities who have, you know, credibility and from reputable institutions around the world, but it also will include diplomats. It will also include interlocutors, because we have amazing diplomats. You know, we have amazing, you know, people in the Foreign Office who are, you know, fully kind of understand and very well versed in many of these aspects. So you would still be using their expertise, but from an authoritative perspective, you would definitely bring the faith-based actors into the equation. And the argument there is that when they speak, hopefully people will take heed and listen to. The caveat to this is obviously the whole principle of authority and whose authority do you submit to? And we do have situations with non-state actors and those that are, you know, on the extreme fringes of society that go on to engage in violent extremism. One of the problems is that there's a total disregard for authority. But sometimes you can kind of get around this by inculcating, incorporating leadership who they would, you know, pay respect to. And you know, and hopefully the council and the consensus that is reached can sway the decision-making of such bodies or groups as part of that equation,
That's absolutely fascinating to hear. Now, in your book, one of the topics you cover is the conflict in Kashmir. So if you could just explain that briefly for our audience.
Yeah, so obviously the princely state of Kashmir, it's you know, it's been, since partition, it's been an area of dispute between India and Pakistan. And obviously China is also part of the equation. And in terms of international kind of legal structure, there is the right to self-determination, the plebiscite that should have taken place, but it's not taking place to date. It's not been activated. And over the years, there's been many, you know, confrontations between India and Pakistan regarding this particular region. And to date, there's no real kind of resolution or, you know, a meaningful resolution that's materialized. In the last couple of years, we've had the situation about what the Indian administration has done with Article 370, Article 35A, in terms of, you know, some of the land rights and property rights that existed for the Kashmiris in that region, that's been kind of taken away. And that's led to more, you know, difficulties in the region for the people that live there. And, you know, international observers have called this, you know, a militarized zone, an occupied zone. And, you know, in terms of human rights violations, international reports have been written on this too. And so when you look at it from that prism, you know, it does look quite gloomy, sadly, in terms of, you know, the pathway towards a resolution. So this is something why I wanted to explore that in more detail. So
in the case of Kashmir, how would theodiplomacy and Islamic principles be applied to potentially resolve this conflict?
So when I looked at the situation in Kashmir, straight away you realize that, you know, it's not just the Muslims that live in that region. You have a diverse, eclectic mix of, you know, different communities, from the Buddhist tradition, from the Hindu faith tradition. So the theodiplomacy model, which I talk about, is using the expertise and interlocutors that I just talked about in terms of the senior leadership from the priests, from the rabbis, from the Hindu representatives. And what they will do is they act as a check and balance, first and foremost, for any individual organization that is, first and foremost, sometimes using the tool of religiosity to justify their actions in a misconstrued manner. So the classic example will be is that what today the RSS, on the auspices of the RSS or the Hindutva ideology is doing in parts of Kashmir. So the argument being is that normative people of, you know, mainstream faith-based, you know, representatives and adherents will categorically condemn that and say this has got nothing to do with our faith tradition. So that condemnation, first and foremost, will act as a check from this body as a kind of reconciliative tool. And then, and secondly, thereafter, by, you know, the rights-based structure that exists within international law discourse, as in first and foremost the right to a plebiscite for the people of Kashmir, that not only concludes the principle that they can join either side, as in, you know, they want to be part of Pakistan or India, but even their own autonomy, if they want to be independent, that should also be part of the equation. So these are all kind of the rights which exist within a democratic framework, and which Islamic law, you know, orientates and gives legitimacy to, so does international law. So these are the facilitative tools I feel that people who are engaged as interlocutors can, you know, use as part of the equation. And then one thing is always worth mentioning is that when you talk about third-party mediators to a conflict, this is also part of Islamic law, to bring in third parties as conciliators and arbitrators to broker a resolution. And similarly, it's part of international law. So this is where neutral arbitrators or mediators who can play a meaningful role, who have leverage, can act as brokering a speedy resolution to this long conflict. I think this is where these are some of the tools that can be used as part of this in an effective way. And just finally on this point is something which I recommend is an International Peace and Reconciliation Council at the United Nations level, where countries would submit to from a jurisdictional perspective. So they all have to obviously adhere to the kind of the rulings that come from this council. And this would include the expertise which I just alluded to before. And again, that could act as a check and a check and balance for any groups or organizations that are, just going off the rails in terms of their practices and leading to a pathway of destruction and more devastation rather than facilitating a pathway towards peace.
Well, absolutely. That sounds very inspiring stuff. What would you say to those people who would perhaps criticize the theodiplomatic model and argue that religion does not have a place in diplomacy? How would you respond?
That's a really good question. And obviously, a lot of people would say that this is all politics at play, politicians using the clinging onto power, the grabbing of lands and misappropriation of property, all that kind of stuff. But my argument is that we're living in a world today now, in a global village, where the religiosity, be it as an undertone or as an overtone, is being used and misrepresented. And a lot of these groups who are engaged in these conflicts used paradigms of religiosity in what they are trying to do in a particular region, most often in the case, in a misrepresentative manner. In fact, probably say most of the time that's the case. So this is where the theodiplomacy model, which I advocate, I feel has an effective role to play. So I'm saying, what is the flip side to this? You don't have it and you continue as you are, or you bring this into the table as an option to be used at the ready as a facilitative tool. And I feel that by having that option will be a help rather than a hindrance.
Absolutely. Now, have you ever come across in your research any examples of the theodiplomatic model in practice? Has it ever been done before?
When I was looking at some of the examples in recent times, and obviously, first and foremost, I look at South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that took place in South Africa. And again, we had people from different faith traditions and none that were part of that. And incorporated in there the principles of reconciliation, the principle of healing, and people acknowledging the crimes that they have committed openly, as part of that Reconciliation Commission. So what happened there is pretty much in tandem with the principles which I allude to, as part of the diplomacy model. Then I'm looking at other places around the world. We have, in more recent times, we had the Bosnia, what happened in Bosnia, and the post-war reconstruction and reconciliation that took place there between the different communities is another example where you can see this in practice. And going back also at the other theaters around the world, we had what happened in Rwanda with the Tutsis and the post-conflict reconstruction, the healing, the trauma, and I've seen how people engage in interfaith dialogue after that to bring people together. So it's not just a one-time aspect. This is one thing we have to appreciate is that, what I talk about in the book is about sustainable peace. And this is something which is very important also, in the sense that some conflicts, you may have a one-time resolution, then a week later they're at it again. Mm. But to achieve sustainable peace, it takes a lot of graft and endeavor, and you have to plant seeds for that to then, to be able to endure for the long run. And I guess even closer to home, what we have in Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement, I would say that that's still diplomacy. That place there, taking place there too, to bring about, opposing party sides from different sides of the spectrum together and come to a common agreement. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we've also seen that the Vatican is quite an active diplomatic player in its own right, perhaps providing another example of theodiplomacy. Now, what I would like to ask is, how do you think the Global South would respond to the concepts outlined in your book?
That's a really good question. What I would say is that I think there would be a lot of resonance to the concept which I talk about in my book, because as we just alluded to already, that there is this perception sometimes in the Global South, post-colonial history, that, you know, we've been, you know, under the rule of another power for many years. And, you know, now the time has come to change. The geopolitical realignments that are taking place now with you know, countries like China, the ASEAN blocs that have been created, you know, in the Asia Pacific and so forth. So, and then a lot of the time, there may be this perception that the cultural norms and understanding that exist in the global south sometimes may not be fully understood, you know, in the Western Hemisphere. So I feel that, you know, in terms of the endeavor that I've made in this book, probably will, I'm hoping, I mean, obviously I can't, you know, say for 100 for sure, but I would hope that they would, you know, it will resonate and they'll accept it in a positive manner because of covering these anomalies and these norms. And one thing I would probably mention, which is also important in terms of Islamic law, is there's a principle called urf, which is customary norms. So this is respecting the norms and, you know, the cultural norms of a society, which is very important also, you know. So it's not something which is a top-down, you know, kind of vertical approach to any kind of jurisdictional analysis. It's very much a holistic in its mannerisms and how it goes about, you know, its implementation. Yeah.
So you would say that, in summary, that a lot of the principles of international law that we in the West take for granted are perhaps not as appropriate from the perspective of the rest of the world, as they can seem like an imposition from above, and that you think that there may be more legitimacy involved in a theodiplomatic approach.
I think you partially probably got that right. I think what I would say is that when I've studied this in depth is that the principles and the ethics of international law, in terms of, as I mentioned, justice, human rights, you know, the right to education, sustainable peace, which is including, you know, United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the right to education, gender equality. These are all principles which are not only in international law, but they also exist in Islamic law. So, and what we are finding sometimes in the global south is that some of these principles and these rights are not being, you know, given to people in a meaningful way. A classic example is in Afghanistan today, the right to education. The girls are not, you know, are being denied the right to education. And this is something which Islamic law, you know, permits the right for girls to be educated. International law gives the right to education, a fundamental human right. But yet, for whatever reason, you have, you know, certain groups who just don't align to that. This is where my model, which I'm talking about as part of the Reconciliation Council, would kick in and act as a check and a balance to such actors who are just, you know, in terms of their decision-making is totally off the rails in terms of the norms of contemporary society. So to answer your question, I think there are elements even in international law that actually are valid and have credence and relevance even in the global south, because the principles are not being applied correctly and they need to be applied properly. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, you've mentioned before the importance of third parties and brokers to act in conflict resolution. Can you think of any examples of any countries or religious organizations or even individuals who might, in your mind, serve as good third party mediators?
Yes. So, I mean, obviously, this can be contentious because obviously, for one person, it may be, you know, a suitable country, another may not. But I guess it depends on what the conflict theater is. So if we take, for example, the situation in Kashmir, you know, who would be a third party kind of mediator? And obviously what you have to look at is into the real politics of the world that we're living in and, you know, the leverage. So when I look at something like Kashmir, I think of the UAE. And the reason why I say that is because there's a lot of economic ties that India have with the UAE, and, you know, even with Pakistan as a neighboring country, and also with China also. So this is a player which there are strategic interests at stake, but it's not directly involved in the conflict as such. So by acting as an arbitrator, it could, you know, have a meaningful role to play. And I think there's also a case for countries, you know, more in the West too. So maybe, you know, countries like Canada could also play a role from a kind of, you know, as a broker, as a facilitator, as an arbitrator in terms of third parties. And so, and obviously, it doesn't have to be one country. It can be multiple countries that are engaged. But these are some of the countries that come to mind that I think can play a pivotal role in the region. And obviously, the key thing is there's not just neutrality, but leverage, you know, in terms of they can get things moving. You know.
So, Kalim, one other aspect of your book is the concept of humanitarianism. Could you elaborate on this, please?
Yes, so thank you very much. So as I alluded to in our talk thus far, that the principles of humanity are something that resonates between the two systems, international law and Islamic law. And I just wanted to give you some examples of, you know, how that kind of plays out within the Islamic kind of system at large. So the fourth caliph in the Islamic tradition, Hazrat Ali, he mentions that there, you know, in his one of his sayings, there are two types of people. There's one, your brother in religion, or your peers in humanity. So straight away, there is that the principle there of humanitarianism. And then even within the classical Islamic tradition, it talks about the principle that he or she that saves one life is as if they have saved the whole of, you know, humanity. So that's where the preservation of life is sacrosanct. And this is something which is, you know, which is not only, you know, very much enshrined within the principles of international law, but also within Islamic law. And it's, I think, worth mentioning here as something there's a lot of synergy between the two.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. So, Kaleem, thank you so much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating. If you'd like to sort of plug your book at the end, just, you know, feel free.
Yeah, so thank you very much for the opportunity. And as I mentioned, I hope that my book is called Peace and Reconciliation in International Islamic Law. It is available from Cambridge Scholar Publishing. And I'll do the usual plug. It's available in all good, you know, bookstores. Hopefully, you know, it'll be available for you for your consumption. And I do hope that you find it beneficial in understanding some of the kind of the nuances that exist between the two systems. And and the aim was to for it to be applicable to not only, you know, the diplomats, the international community at large, but across section of society, so that they can, you know, just get appreciation of how the two systems work together and the synergies that exist and the differences. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Kaleem.
You're welcome. Thank you.